Okay, everyone, welcome back. Are you ready? How's your tummy? Tummy's okay? Not too full, just right? Yeah? Okay. Sometimes they call, when they have a conference, they call the session after lunch, you call it the graveyard session, because everybody's kind of completely... You have to be either very funny or very clever to be able to keep people's attention in the graveyard session. So we'll see what happens. Okay, so we're going to continue with our exciting suttas. And for those of you who are new, if you feel you get a little bit lost, please ask any time. Yeah? Say, too fast, too whatever, yeah? And then we'll see how things go. So, we have looked at some of the introductory suttas. And now I'm going to get into the main topic for this retreat, which is dependent origination. We're going to talk about this in many different ways. But the first thing I want to do is just to talk about, go through the whole series of dependent origination fairly quickly, briefly, to give a kind of framework and background for how this works. And just to give you kind of a rough idea. As with so many things in the Dhamma, the more often you hear something, the different angles you hear it from, the more it starts to come together and it makes sense. So that's why a summary version and then a detailed version later on, and perhaps a summary version at the end again, is what I was thinking for this. And this is one of the techniques you will see the Buddha uses in the suttas. He often starts with a summary version of a sutta. He gives a detailed analysis, which is called the Vibhanga very often. The Udesa is a summary, Vibhanga is the exposition, and then maybe a summary at the end again. This is kind of standard techniques for teachers, yeah? Even today, teachers use these kind of techniques for explaining things. Dependent origination is a series of 12 steps or 12 links, yeah? And each of these links or each of these factors is connected to the next one. So if you have one factor, factor A, it becomes the cause or the condition for factor B. Factor B is the cause and condition for factor C. And then it goes all the way up to the 12th factor. One factor leading on to the next one. It's a causal sequence. And this is one of the things that the Buddha excelled in. One of the hallmarks of the Dhamma is this idea of causality. So maybe first of all, why is it that causality is so important in Buddhism? What is it about Buddhism that kind of makes itself especially open to causality? Do you know why what is the case? Why is causality so important in the Buddhist teachings? And the answer is that in most religions, in most philosophical systems, sometimes you have things that are permanent, things that are absolute entities. Yeah, you have things. Christianity has the soul, Islam has the soul. Most religions, in Hinduism, you have Brahma or the absolute sense of self, the Atman. So almost all teachings have something that is independent, that stands there like a rock, which is kind of immobile, which is not moved by any other cause or conditions in the world. This is the idea of a self in Buddhism. Yeah, Buddhism talks about non-self, the idea that there's something which is independent of all external or internal causes, which is it's like a mountain peak. Yeah, just stands there. But Buddhism says there is no such thing here. There is nothing which is permanent, everlasting, independent of external things. And because if there isn't anything which is, has this independence from other phenomena, it means that everything is conditional. Everything relates to something else. Everything is caused through, if you like, a network of cause and conditions. When a number of cause and conditions come together, then B happens, yeah? And then a B plus another number of causes and conditions come together and C happens. Everything is networked in this way. Yeah? And this is very interesting, because what it means is that we have an opportunity to influence our lives. Everything that happens in our lives does not happen because of a God, because of the self, because of any other permanent phenomenon. It always happens because of other conditioned phenomena. Because conditioned phenomena by their very nature are subject to change and they are influenceable, it means that we can influence our lives. We can do something. Yeah, this is the great thing about the Dhamma. Everything has a everything. We are able to do something with almost everything in our lives. If you want to make ourselves more happy, we can. If you want to make ourselves more suffering, we can. Yeah, but please don't do that. It's not advisable. If we want to, if you really want to make yourself wealthy, if you want to be, you can actually do that because there are cause and conditions for how to become wealthy. If you think that's a good idea to become really, really wealthy, then actually the Buddha Dhamma will tell you how to do that. But I'm not here to tell you that, right? And it's funny because sometimes, the idea of being wealthy, it's kind of, we're conditioned by maybe television or conditioned by reading about wealthy people in the paper and think, wow, being wealthy is so powerful. But I have seen wealthy people. Yeah, actually my family even is reasonably wealthy. But I recently stayed with a really wealthy man in Singapore. And a very nice man, Buddhist man, very friendly, very kind of, not very arrogant. Sometimes wealthy people can become a bit arrogant and unpleasant, but he was actually very nice. But I stay with them and you realize they're just like ordinary people. It doesn't change very much in life whether you are very wealthy or not, or even if you're very powerful. It's pretty much the same, yeah? Same problems. The kids aren't really behaving properly. He was talking to me, saying, oh, my sons are not doing what they should do. And I thought, yeah, so much for wealth. I thought, you still have exactly the same thing. My company, he was a businessman. My company, people aren't doing the right thing or whatever. Yeah, there you are. So the same things. It doesn't really change things. So, but if that's really what you want, Buddhism will tell you how to become wealthy. How do you become wealthy? Well, obviously, one thing is to make good karma. The other thing was to work hard. Yeah, if you work really hard and you have make good karma, then you're kind of heading towards wealth. But anyway, it doesn't really solve any problems. So I wouldn't really recommend you go there. It's okay to be wealthy. It doesn't matter if you happen to become wealthy. That's fine. But don't make that your main goal in life. If that becomes your main goal, then often you end up doing all kind of silly things on the way because of the nature of the goal. Instead, look at the process. How you get there, much more important than what you actually get. If you can work on the process, get the process right, then even if you don't become wealthy, you will still have done the right thing, and good things will happen as a result. So everything in Buddhism is causal. We can produce the results that we want if we put in the right causes. It's great, yeah. It's a wonderful, one of those wonderful things about the Buddhist teachings. And this is what dependent origination is about. It means that if you have a tendency to get angry, the reasons why you get angry are very clearly laid down by the Buddha. The reasons why we have metta instead of friendliness instead is also very clearly laid down by the Buddha. We can talk about this later on if you like. So it's not that hard. It takes perseverance, it takes commitment not to get angry and to have metta, but it's not hard. The cause and conditions are very obvious. So this is what dependent origination is all about. It's about causality in this sense. And to understand the purpose of dependent origination, what we have to look at is the goal of dependent origination. What is it pointing to? So you have 12 links, yeah? At the very beginning, you have a link called avijja. At the very end, you have the link called jara marana, or dukkha, if you like. And dukkha is obviously suffering. Jara marana is old age and death, yeah? This is the final point. This is what it's aiming at. It's looking towards. This is the goal, if you like, of dependent origination. So it shows us how suffering arises in the world. Why is there suffering? This is what dependent origination is all about. It's pretty useful, yeah. The whole Buddhist teaching is about ending suffering. It's about finding real happiness in life. And this shows us the causal sequence from the very root, how suffering actually arises. What the problem in human life, obviously suffering. So it shows us the problem for human life, any life, not just humans, any kind of life at all. What is the problem? How it can be resolved? And it shows this going backwards, stage by stage backwards, until you come to the root cause for suffering. Very often when we talk about the cause of suffering, we talk about tanha, about craving. That's what you find in the Second Noble Truth. You'll have a look at that afterwards. Craving is the cause of suffering. But dependent origination is like an expansion of the Second Noble Truth. It takes it back further, back to an even more root cause than craving itself. And that more root cause is avijja. Avijja is often translated as ignorance into English, which is not, I think, ideal translation, because ignorance means, I don't have any education. I haven't been to university. I don't know anything about what's happening in the world. That's kind of ignorance. But that's not what it means in Buddhism. In Buddhism, avijja means literally blindness. It means delusion. It means you haven't got a clue what's going on. You think one thing, but actually it's the exact opposite of what you think. That's delusion. Like, one of Ajahn Brahm's favorite sayings is like, what the noble ones say is suffering, ordinary people say is happiness. What the noble ones say is happiness, ordinary people say is suffering. You have got it completely upside down. You haven't got a clue what's going on. That's avijja. It's delusion, illusion, a complete misunderstanding, non-understanding of reality as it actually is. And that's the problem, If you don't see things according to reality, you've got a problem. So dependent origination shows you how this blindness and darkness that we have, how that leads to suffering. That's what it shows us. If you're blind, don't see things right, it will lead to suffering as a consequence. This is what it shows you. So the answer then, of course, to the whole thing is to remove that blindness. And when you remove the blindness, the whole thing unravels. And suffering comes to an end because of that. So to understand this in a simple way, why it is that delusion or illusion must lead to suffering, is actually the basic idea is very easy to understand. So let's say that you invest on the stock market. Any of you invest on the stock market here? Any of you stock market investors? Some of you invest on stock market. Good. Okay. Many people do that. It's perfectly fine. I'm not sure. Is it called gambling or investing? Stock market. Kind of halfway between. I'm a bit uncertain. Anyway, let's say we call it investment, just to be polite. So investing on the stock market, it depends what kind of advice you have. You use a broker. You have a kind of broker that you use, maybe. I don't know how you do things, but maybe you do online. But very in the old days, before people started kind of doing online investment, you would have an investment broker, sitting in the bank somewhere, and they would give you advice, on what kind of stocks were doing well, etc. So now, depending on the kind of broker, maybe you had a really dodgy broker who didn't have a clue what was going on. He was maybe alcoholic, some of these brokers, they have pretty rough lives, really kind of working really hard, and he kind of lost the plot completely, and he didn't know what he was doing, so he gave you advice. He gave you completely the wrong advice. Those companies that were really dodgy, everything was going wrong with them, the management was about to be kicked out, and they were about to go bankrupt. He said, hey, buy that one. This is high risk, but if it works out, the return can be really great or whatever. Of course, if you have a bad broker, that's like being ignorant. You haven't got a clue what's going on. You're getting the wrong advice. You are deluded. You think a company is good when actually it's really bad. And when you invest in that company, what happens? You suffer. You lose $10,000 or 100,000 ringgit or 1 million ringgit. Or I don't know how much you invest, but all this money just goes down the drain. How does that feel? It doesn't feel nice. How does it feel when you invest and you lose money? You feel kind of, doesn't feel good, Afterwards you feel bad about it. Because, of course, we have some degree of attachment to our money. It's just natural. If, on the other hand, if you have a really good broker who is on top of things, maybe has a bit of insider information, that's illegal. So don't, when I say this, I'm just saying this as an example. Don't use insider information to buy any stocks. But, I remember there was a very wealthy man. He said something like, all good share trading is insider trading. I think that's what he said. Because when you have inside information, that's the only time you really know what you're doing. Otherwise, you're just kind of fumbling around. Anyway, that's what he said. I'm not sure if that's a good quote for the Dhamma talk. But So, but if you have a very good broker who knows what's going on, he has kind of semi-inside information. He has not really insider, but he's very kind of clued into what's going on. And then you buy those shares, of course, then you have right view. You have the right understanding of reality. Yeah, because you're not deluded. You invest in a suitable place. The stock goes up and you make money. And you feel, yay, money. And you get more money. And then you get really afraid of losing the money afterwards. That's the downside of becoming wealthy, doing well, is that you get fear afterwards of losing what you've got. It's always like that. There's always a downside to these things. So that's just to show you that it is true in our ordinary life. If we are blind about what's going on, we're going to cause suffering for ourselves. If we are clear about what's going on, if we have a clear idea of the world around us, then we are going to cause happiness. This is a very shallow happiness to make heaps of money, but still, it's a little bit of happiness there. Let's face it. Yeah, or if somebody gives you wrong directions, say, I need to go to this particular place. So they give you the wrong directions. Yeah, then of course that's the delusion, having the wrong directions, and you don't get there compared to getting the right directions. Similar kind of thing. So it's quite obvious, I think, in our worldly life, but also in our spiritual life. If we have clarity, we're not in the dark, but the light is turned on, we can see what's happening, then we can make good decisions, and we will gain happiness as a consequence of that. The kind of happiness we're talking about in worldly life is small happiness. Yeah, okay, you make a million ringgit or whatever, big deal. Doesn't make much difference. Maybe for you it is a big deal if you have a big loan, but still it's not a big deal. But if you get it right in the spiritual life, wow, you really hit the jackpot. Because this is happiness, which is not just temporary. It's not happiness where you have to fear to lose it afterward. This is real happiness in the present moment. You sit down in meditation and you feel, wow, this is the highest bliss you ever have experienced in your entire life. You feel, this is it. I found the meaning of life. Yeah, this is what it's like to kind of really get it together in your meditation practice. Incredibly powerful, and you feel this is really the jackpot, big time. I've really kind of, found basically the answer to the meaning of life itself. So this is how, why this is so important. So what this sequence does then, it shows you, starting with ignorance, through 12 steps, how you get to suffering at the end. So each of these steps, you have avidya, paccaya, sankhara. Yeah, this is Pali. Avidya, paccaya, sankhara. Avidya is the cause for sankharas. Yeah, sankhara, paccaya, vijnana. Vijnana is the cause for, sankhara is the cause for vijnana. Paccaya is the thing which goes between each step all the way. It means cause. So what does cause mean? Exactly how? What does it mean? What kind of causality? Causality can be many different things. What do we mean by causality here? And what we mean is that when one condition is in place, the other one, the subsequent one, has to arise if the previous condition is in place. There is no choice anymore. So if there is ignorance, you have to have the second one, which is called sankhara. You can translate it as activities now, just as a temporary translation. Once you have ignorance, you get activities as a consequence of that. Yeah, there is no choice. To give you a better way to... Okay, just to give you a little bit more flesh on those bones, sometimes in English we're talking about two kinds of causality here. Necessary causality and sufficient causality here. And for each one of these steps, both each one is a necessary and sufficient cause for the following one. So if you have avidya, if you have ignorance, that is sufficient. In other words, it's enough for to be absolutely sure sankhara will happen. It is also necessary. If you don't have avidya, sankhara cannot happen. You have to have avidya for sankhara to happen. Yeah? So necessary and sufficient causality. But essentially all you need to know is that when one is in place, the subsequent one has to happen. That is what this is referring to. So this is a dependent origination. So once avidya is there, it goes from link to link to link. Each one, the next one has to happen, all the way to suffering. If you have avidya, you have no choice. You have to suffer. There's no such thing as having avidya, having ignorance and not suffering. It's impossible. If you think you're not suffering, it's just because you are deluded. I'm so happy.
You have to know this, find it out for yourself, yeah? Gradually, you uncover this until you understand what the Buddha means by these things. So that is how the sequence works in brief. This is kind of the major outlook of dependent origination. Another thing that dependent origination shows us, because this is, as I said before, all about causality, one thing leading to another one. The Buddhist teaching is through and through about causality. It shows us how things happen precisely without recourse, without using the self. There's no need for a self in there. Yeah. Often when you have causality, there's something kind of going through the sequence. But in dependent origination, there's nothing which actually goes through the sequence, which is always there. One thing just leads to another one, and there's no kind of pillar in the middle of it which holds it together. It's just elements, one leading to another one. So it takes away the need for a self. Yeah? And this is one of those conundrums that people often ask. How can we have rebirth without a self? Because, for it to be rebirth, what is it that gets reborn? How can something go from there to there and actually no self in between? How is that possible? And the answer is dependent origination. Huh? The answer is one cause has an effect. Yeah? There's no need for anything permanent to go through there. Huh? So it shows us how suffering arises from ignorance without any need to bring in the idea of the self. This is also what dependent origination shows us. It's a very profound doctrine. It has all these elements in it, yeah? And all of these elements are a part of what this is about. And the third thing then that dependent origination also shows us, it shows us the process of rebirth itself as part of this. Part of this production of suffering is the idea of rebirth. Rebirth is so important in the Buddhist teaching. If there is no rebirth, imagine that you just, when you die, okay, that's it, you're finished. There isn't any major problem there. Yeah, life isn't that bad for most people. Yeah, none of you look entirely miserable. You look okay. Yeah, you don't look like you're ready to commit suicide or anything like that. So because of that, life, generally speaking, most people have bad times, they have good times, but they can kind of bear with life usually. So if everything ends when you die, okay, no big problem. It's the fact that you get reborn and it goes on, which actually is the problem of Buddhism. And this is why, to show us how suffering happens, the idea of rebirth has to be integrated into dependent origination. When it's integrated into it, it shows us this process, including how rebirth happens as part of this process. So suffering is just perpetuated, yeah? It happens again and again and again and again, going on and on forever. And that is the problem here. Things always happening again and again in this way. That's why it is such a problem. That is just a little bit of the background on this dependent origination. What I'm going to do now is to go through the various links in a little bit more detail so that you can have some grasp, at least, of what is happening here. Are you happy with what I have said so far? Make sense? Yeah? Yeah? Okay. Yeah. If you are completely confused, it's okay to be completely confused. Yeah, you don't have to be kind of super duper on the ball, anything like that. So first one, let me read this out because this is the Buddha's how he actually talks about this. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling at Savatthi in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. There the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus, the monks, thus, "Bhikkhus, venerable sir," those bhikkhus replied, "the Blessed One said this." So here we have the Buddha dwelling at Savatthi, Jeta's Grove. Savatthi, one of the great cities of India at that time, the capital of the Kosalan kingdom, that was ruled by King Pasenadi, who was a contemporary of the Buddha. And they were very good friends, actually. King Pasenadi would often come out to the Buddha to listen to talks, and then he would come out to this monastery called Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Monastery. I think it's better to call it Anathapindika's Monastery than Anathapindika's Park. And there's a famous story behind this, how how the Jeta Grove became Anathapindika's monastery, because Jeta, he was a prince, and he was very wealthy, and he was very kind of, and he had this park just outside of Savatthi, and that's what princes do, I guess they own parks and things, and otherwise, if you what's the point of being a prince if you can't own the odd park here and there? So, so he had this park called Jeta's Grove, that was his kind of personal park. And then Anathapindika, he was a very wealthy merchant at the time, and he had gained faith in the Buddha while the Buddha was staying at Rajagaha, and he went out to see the Buddha, and he was kind of awestruck by the Buddha the first time, and he went, "Wow! Whoa, this is amazing!" Yeah, and he must have become a stream enter very, very soon at the first meeting, because he was so kind of filled with faith and confidence by meeting the Buddha. I guess if you are ready in the Dhamma, and you would have a very powerful impact on you when you meet somebody extraordinary. And obviously, who is the most extraordinary of all the extraordinary people? That's obviously the Buddha. So he got so much faith, but he was actually from Savatthi. His home was in Savatthi. So the Buddha then went back to Savatthi. The Buddha started walking to Savatthi. And Anathapindika thought, well, how can I help the Buddha find a nice place to stay when he gets to Savatthi? You may have heard this story before, perhaps. And then he goes back to Savatthi and he realizes, well, actually, this Jeta Grove is perfect. It is just outside the city walls. If you have been to Savatthi, the ancient embankments of Savatthi are still there. You can see the embankment, you can see the city kind of almost inside there. And then the Jeta Grove is kind of a few hundred meters away from those ancient embankments. Everything is still there. You can still see it in the present day, roughly what it must have looked like at that time. And so he thinks it's perfect. It's not too close, not too far away, suitable for coming into Savatthi for alms food for the monks, but not so close that they will get disturbed by the traffic and by the people, by the noise. So I will go to Prince Jeta and I will tell him I want to buy your park. So he goes to Prince, I want to buy your park. No way, that's my park. You're not going to have it. You know, go away, you merchant. And well, he was a prince, so he was kind of high caste. And Anathapindika was just a merchant. The merchant was kind of lower caste, so he was probably maybe also a bit kind of arrogant, perhaps. I don't know. I'm just making it up, but possibly, because that's usually how these things are. Yeah. If you're high caste, you're a bit arrogant. But Anathapindika, very persevering, yeah, and saying, no, I really want this park for the Sangha. Name your price. Everything has a price in this world. Yeah, nothing has changed. Those days were like that, now it's also like everything has a price. So if you kind of pay enough, things will tend to happen. So Prince Jeta thought, well, I'm gonna give you a price you can't afford, yeah? So that will be the end of the story. And he said, well, if you can cover the entire Jeta Grove with pieces of gold, yeah, with golden coins, it's like a large area, yeah? So if you had to cover the whole area with gold coins, then you can have the park. This is a bit of a legend. I don't think actually this happened, but it's a nice kind of legend. And then, of course, Anathapindika, he was so wealthy that he was able to cover the entire Jeta Grove, large area, with gold coins. And then Prince Jeta realized, oh, I lost my park, yeah. I made a bet. I said, if you can do this, I wasn't really serious. I thought nobody could do this. Okay, so you have to have the park. So this is how he gained this park, through his incredible faith in the Buddha. And it almost decimated him. He was very poor, not very poor, but he was relatively poor after that, because most of his fortune went to buy the monastery for the Buddha in this way. So much faith, yeah, incredible confidence in the Buddha. This is what drove this kind of thing here. And then the Buddha got there, and this is where he stayed. And this is what was the main hangout for the Buddha. Is that disrespectful to call it hangout? I don't know. Got to translate this into modern terminology. Yeah? So modern terminology. So this is where the Buddha used to stay. And he spent, they say, over 20 years in this particular monastery. And this is where a lot of his teachings are actually based, in this monastery. One word of caution, you read the suttas, very often it starts off with at Savatthi. And do you know why it says that so often? Well, that's one reason, yeah? But there's another reason. This is a reason which isn't so well known. And if there's one scripture in the, I think Mula Srivastavadan scriptures, and they talk about reciting the suttas, and how you're supposed to recite the suttas. And the question is, well, what happens if you've forgotten the place where the Buddha was staying? What do you do then? And they said, well, if you've forgotten the place, you put in Savati. So that is one of the reasons, maybe, why Savati is found so many places, possibly. It's strange how these things are, yeah? Because this was considered not unimportant information. What matters is that you remember the sutta correctly. Whether you remember the city, okay, city was there, city was there, who cares, yeah? Not so important. And sometimes when you read the suttas, that's exactly what you find. You compare the Chinese version with the Pali version, and the Chinese version said Rajagaha. The Pali version says Savati. Yeah? So, okay. Don't really know where it was. It was in India. Okay, good enough. That's how it works. So, Savati, Anathapindika's monastery. So, we don't really know whether the Buddha taught this sutta in Savati, but guarantee that he taught about dependent origination there, because it was a very important teaching here. And he says, bhikkhus, and they reply, venerable sir, Bhante, they replied to him. Bhante was a term used for the Buddha all the time. Yeah, it's very interesting here. And these days it's used for Buddhist monks sometimes. In those days it was used of the Buddha himself. Bhikkhus, I will teach you dependent origination, paticca samuppada. Listen to that and attend closely. I will speak. Yes, venerable sir, those bhikkhus replied. Yeah, Buddha often says at the beginning, listen. Yeah, listen and attend closely. In other words, pay attention. Try hard to understand what I'm saying. This is one of those things about the teachings. The Buddha says that in many places. You know, give an ear. Apply your mind to understand what is happening here. Paticca samuppada. Samuppada means like to originate. Paticca means dependent on conditions and causes. So the translation dependent origination is actually quite good, even though you may wonder, dependent origination sounds a bit foreign straight away. Yeah, dependent origination. Yeah, well, things originate because of causes. Things come about because of conditions and causes. That's what dependent origination, the word actually means. So, the Blessed One said this. What, bhikkhus, is dependent origination? With ignorance as condition, there are volitional formations. With volitional formations as conditions, there is consciousness. With consciousness as condition, there is name and form. With name and form as condition, you have the six sense bases. With the six sense bases and condition, you have a contact. With contact as a condition, you have feeling. With feeling as condition, you have craving. With craving as condition, you have clinging. With clinging as condition, you have existence. With existence as condition, you have birth. With birth as condition, you have old age, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. This, bhikkhus, is called dependent origination. Is it clear? Yeah? At this point, people say, oh, okay, maybe I better go now. I think I've had enough of the Dhamma. When you are, sorry. Baba, yeah. So, you the new one. Are you feel confused now? Do you understand anything at all? Trying to, really good, yeah. So I'm going to explain this, because this is very hard to understand as it is like this. It's one of those very cryptic teachings. If you read this on your own in the suttas, you think, whoa, no idea what this is about. Yeah, first time, this blank. Yeah, it seems like this kind of series of words, and you wonder, what on earth is this about? So let's try to, I will draw out the meaning of this, so that we can hopefully gain some traction in understanding what is going on. So first of all, ignorance is more like delusion. What does it mean? It means that we don't understand things according to reality. It means we don't have insight into the Four Noble Truths. It means, one of the most basic things it means is that we don't understand anicca, impermanence, unreliability. We don't understand dukkha, suffering. We think that what is happiness is actually suffering. We think that what is happiness is suffering. We think that what is suffering is happiness. And we don't understand anatta, non-self. The three characteristics of existence, that is roughly what it comes down to. We are deluded about that. We think that things are permanent when they are not. We think that things are happiness when they are not. We think that there is a self inside of us. We feel real, yeah. We feel this is me. You feel that now, right now, this is me, I'm sitting here, yeah? And there's some sense of reality to that me. You can feel the reality of me here. I am the agent, I can do this, I can read this if I want to, I don't have to. I can have a cup of coffee, but I'm going to wait a couple of minutes, yeah? Me, the agent, you feel that, we all feel that we exist to some extent. That sense of existence, says the Buddha, is actually an illusion. So we don't understand reality. That's what, especially in terms of those three characteristics. That is what the Buddha talks about. Now, that because of that lack of understanding of reality, then volitional formations come to be. Volitional formations is one of the worst translations in the Pali canon, because it doesn't mean anything. Yeah, for me, it means nothing. Volitional formations. I mean, if you think about it carefully, you will get some meaning out of it. But it's very hard to really understand. So what I prefer to call this is willed activities. Yeah, willed activities. The willpower, the will is there, and we act based on that will. So actions that come from will is what this really means. Intentional actions, if you like, is one way of putting it. Intentional activities, willed activities. So from, if you are deluded, you start having willed activities. Why is that? What is happening here? It's not that hard to understand if we look at this very carefully. The reason is because we think that there is happiness in the world. We think that there are things that we have to go out and get. Yeah, we think that if we have get into a nice relationship, if we think that there is we get a good job and all these kind of things, that is happiness in the world. That we just have to exert ourselves. We have to act, and when we act in the right way, we will be able to create that happiness in our lives. Yeah, this is why we have willed activities, because we act so as to create the happiness that we think is out there for us to get. Yeah, it's quite obvious, yeah? So, but this assumes two things. It assumes that we actually know where happiness is. Yeah, if we don't really know what happiness is, we're probably wasting our time, because we're pursuing the wrong stuff. We're pursuing suffering when actually we should be pursuing happiness. So because we think happiness is like in the worldly things, in all of these things in the world, we tend to go out into the world, try to create happiness in our life. This is delusion. We don't understand that actually where we are searching for happiness, we're searching in the wrong place. But then we exert ourselves on the consequence of that. This is the first thing. The second thing is the sense of self. The sense of self tells you, who am I? I am the doer. I am the agent. If I do things, magic happens. If I take this thermos here and pour coffee into that cup, I will be able to drink coffee afterwards. Yeah, so I'm the agent in charge of the coffee here. Is that right? Am I really in charge? But maybe there is no coffee in the thermos. Maybe they forgot to put coffee in there. Yeah, maybe it's so light. What happened? Or maybe it's gone cold. Or maybe it tastes bad. You don't know exactly what it's going to be like. And anyway, what's the big deal with coffee compared to meditation experience or whatever? But there's a sense of being in charge of creating. You can create your happiness. Yeah, this is what we have in inside of ourselves. But this is another illusion, the illusion that we can create our own happiness. First of all, it is an illusion, because usually most of the things in the world are not really under our control in the way we think they are under our control. We cannot really get things the way we want them. At the end of the day, everything we try to control is going to have to go. Yeah, We try to control our life a little bit. We try to do things in such a way that we keep our family together, we have a job and all of these things. But in the end, we can control it only so far. And then nature is going to come and claim back its own and say, this is mine. Yeah, sorry, but these things are going to have to be separated from you. So that sense of agency we have inside of us is lying to us. It tells us we can control, when in fact the amount of control we have is very limited. It isn't that great. Also, what is so interesting about the path of the Buddha is actually when you start to let go of control, when you let go of agency, that is where real happiness is found. Yeah. So it's not in exerting our control that we find happiness, it's actually in letting go of control that we find happiness. So we are deluded twice over. First of all, the agency can't really do anything good for us anyway, because we can't control the world in the way we think we can. Secondly, the agency, the controlling, is actually a problem in its own right. Only when we let go of it can we find real happiness on the Buddhist path. Yeah, so there's two things coming together. Agency, we want to act from inside, and there is a search for happiness. This is what drives us in the world, makes us act. I think I'm going to try the coffee magic, because I have okay, a little bit more dairy. You've done well, but a little bit more sugar. You know, we call this Upatags are really good. You know what we call them? Supatag, exactly right. Supatag is a really good Upatag. If you are called a Dukatag, it's not so good. But if you are Supatag, it's really good. So you're doing really well here. This microphone almost gets in the way when you want to drink, you know. Have you noticed that? Yeah. I can't drink on this side because then it becomes problematic. No, I'm just joking. It's okay, Bobby. I'm being silly. I like to be silly. It's nice to be silly, yeah. Not take things too seriously. It's kind of nice in life. Anyway, so you can hopefully now you can start to see what's going on here. We think we know where happiness is, so we try to pursue happiness. We have the doer inside of us, which we feel we are the agent that can actually create, make things happen in the world. So we use that agent to try to create happiness. First of all, we don't know where happiness is. Second, that agent we have that is a really lousy agent, doesn't really do us much good at all. So because it is based on a double illusion, then when we try to create that happiness, it doesn't lead us where we want to do. But that is what makes us act in the world. This is what makes us do activities, the agent inside plus the illusion that we think we know where happiness is. This is how ignorance, delusion, leads to activities. We act based on our misunderstanding of how the world is. Yeah, it's quite interesting, isn't it? Once you start to unpack this, actually very interesting how this works. Then, based on that, based on our activities, remember, because we are basing this on the will, yeah, the will is doing this for us. It means that these are intentional activities. When we do intentional activities, it leaves an imprint on your mind. Yeah, if and this is what karma is all about. So if I think, yeah, I'm going to say something nasty. Yeah, if I think, hey, I'm going to say something nasty to this person, they deserve it. They've been bad, and I'm going to tell them off, and I'm going to put it straight. Yeah, if I say something nasty to somebody, and how do I feel? I think, oh no, why did I say that? That was terrible. I shouldn't have said that to that person. That was a mistake. I was just getting angry, so I shouldn't have said that nasty thing to that person. So when we do intentional activities that are not nice, we tend to feel bad afterwards. Yeah, I'm sure you have you know what I'm talking about, yeah? Do something which isn't quite right. You always feel a bit, you think, oh, I should have done that afterwards. You feel regret, have a sense of regret about that. And it kind of darkens your mind a little bit, takes away some of the brightness and light and happiness inside of you when you do bad things. But when you do the opposite, when you do a good act, again, it's based on intention, yeah? It comes from this idea that we're going to create happiness in the world. But now you do a good act based on that. You say something kind to somebody. You get this feeling of compassion towards someone, and you just want to say something kind to them. Oh, what a wonderful thing it is to have you as a colleague here at the BGF. Please say these things to each other, yeah? Say, oh, I'm so happy, Bobby, to have you as a colleague here at BGF because you're doing such a wonderful job. Say this thing to each other somehow, because you value each other, yeah? It's so easy to forget to say the kind things to each other. Yeah? And I'm very happy to see all of you here. It's wonderful. I love to come around and, you know, teach Dhamma to people, because wherever I go in the world, I always only see good people. Yeah? By nature, people are good people. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. What's the point of being here if you weren't a good person? And no, you are a good person even before you come here, unless you have a suicide belt around your waist. But no, yeah, but you are okay. Yeah? So I know that already. So we, you know, this creates so much positive feeling when we do this in the right way. So we act in this way. And when you do an act of kindness to somebody, you feel happy about yourself. You feel, yay, I'm living well. I'm doing a good thing. You feel this natural sense of lightness and joy inside because you're living well. So this is what is meant by consciousness here. Your consciousness, your mind, is affected by your willed activities. You are deluded, so you do all the willed activities, and then those willed activities affect your mental state, whether you feel dark or whether you feel light. You do a lot of positive activities, good activities. You are lifting your mind up, you are adding, you are accumulating goodness, making your consciousness light and bright and beautiful and pleasant to be with. It becomes very nice to be at home, yeah? Our real home, where is that? Our real home is our heart or our mind. That's our real home. If you close your eyes and you feel good inside, that's your real home. Ultimately, that's the only home we have, our internal refuge with ourselves. However, if you accumulate many bad things, you are dragging yourself down. And when you close your eyes and you feel, it doesn't feel good to be inside of yourself. Yeah, this is what many people who do bad things in the world, they don't feel good about themselves. So it's good to have compassion for people like that, because they don't understand what they're doing. They are blind. Nobody wants to create suffering for themselves, and yet that is what bad people often do. So we are, through our activities, we are building up all of these things that are both lift our mind up and drag it down. So the sum total of all of those activities is how we will feel about ourselves. This is how consciousness is affected. So consciousness becomes either brighter or darker, or it stays roughly the same, yeah, depending on how we live our lives. Then when we come to our deathbed, excuse me. Then, when we come to our deathbed, we have accumulated all of these activities, yeah? So our consciousness now will have a certain station, a certain level, depending on the kind of activities we have been doing. So if you have been making a bright consciousness for yourself over a long period of time, lifting yourself up and up and up, then when you die, you are kind of at the high level. And that level where your consciousness is when you die, that's where you continue into your next life. Yeah? Because it's natural, just like now in this life, if you don't do anything bad or good, your consciousness will continue on that level, because there's nothing to lift it up or drag it down. In the same way, when you die, whatever level your consciousness is at, that is where it continues into the future life. So if you have lifted up your consciousness, you get reborn, your consciousness is established in a high level, depending on what your level is. If you have dragged yourself down by being foolish and stupid, then you will get reborn in a low level, because your consciousness continues in that low level as a consequence. Your consciousness is established in a high level. What does that mean? Like Devaloka, yeah? One of the places you feel, wow, look at me now. This is really cool, yeah? Transparent body flowing through the air, yeah? Feeling joy and all these kind of things. And you feel very, you know, things are very, very good. And once you, if you get reborn in Devaloka, you experience life in a different way. You don't experience life like a human being experiences life. You experience things differently. You think, wow, this is what Devaloka looks like. Jeepers, yeah, this is pretty cool, yeah. So, and you look around and think, wow, you know, look at this, those, that food. Boy, I wish I had some of that food when I was human. That looks pretty, really ultra delicious. Ambrosia, they call it in Christianity, heavenly food. And you look at kind of your, you know, potential boyfriends and girlfriends and think, whoa, wow, this is really, this is kind of special, you know, altogether different. You look at the kind of beautiful parks, yeah, wow. And where the devas hang out in the beautiful parks, just playing and enjoying himself, the music, heavenly music. Don't believe the stuff about harp music, yeah, it's much more interesting than that. Harp music sounds really, really terrible. So this is what, you know, when you go to heaven, it's nothing special. It's just like being here. It's just better. Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah, it's just, wow, it's just much better. So you perceive the world in a new way. Your perception is changed. What you see is different. You feel things differently. You feel more happiness. Your volition is different because the things that you will, the things that you are interested in, are different from when you were human. Now you're interested in higher pleasures because that's what you have access to. And this is what is meant by nama rupa, yeah, or name and form. Name here just means that we experience the world in a different way. In a sense, you can say we give things different names. We give them heavenly names rather than earthly names, yeah. And that naming is the mental aspect of our experience. We perceive things differently. Our sanya is different. Our vedana, the feelings are different. Our sankharas are different. We exert ourselves for different kind of pleasures. So all of these things are different in this new realm. And rupa is the material aspect of things. Yeah, the forms that we see. Our body is different. We don't have a coarse body as a human body. We have a much lighter body as devas. The things you see around you are much more bright and beautiful. And this is what it means, not vinyana pachaya nama rupa. Once you have been reborn in a higher realm, your experience of the world is different. There are different limits on that experience. You cannot no longer experience human things, and you're quite happy not to experience anything because it was inferior anyway. Just like now, you're quite happy not to experience animal things. Yeah, you're not really interested in that because it's much better to experience human stuff than animal stuff. This is what happens. Your limits on your experience have changed. This is what namarupa means. So vinyana pachanamarupa, this is consciousness and namarupa. Consciousness and your mental content and your experience has changed. And this that combination of those two will then continue within this lifetime that you now have as a deva. Yeah? And when that lifetime ends, and the same thing will happen again. The consciousness, depending on how you have lived, will either go up or down, yeah? And then again, a new kind of nama rupa will arise on that basis. Then, when you have nama rupa established, then of course, when you are in the heavenly realm, you experience things. You experience things through the six senses. That's why it says here that name and form conditions the six senses. Yeah. So you have the six senses. You must mean that you experience things. Because you have six senses, it means that contact here just means that things arise. Yeah, things happen. You start to experience things. That's what contact means. When you have senses, you have experience as a consequence. That is contact. Things on the external world contacting your mind. When you have contact, when you experience things, one of the most important aspects of that is feeling. You feel the world. Feeling in Buddhism means either it's good, it's bad, or it's neutral. Yeah, that's how we tend to divide up our own life. Right? Either you like something, or you don't like it, or it's neutral to you. Kind of the most basic way of looking at things. Because we experience the world in this way, in terms of liking, not liking, or neutral, because of that we crave. Yeah, the stuff we don't like, we want to get rid of. That's called the kind of negative craving. We want to get rid of it. The stuff we like, we want more of, precisely because we like it. That's craving. We want to get that. So feeling naturally must lead to craving. There's not much choice. Because we crave, we try to ensure that our craving is met. This is upadana. Upadana here translated as clinging. Much better to translate it as taking up or attaching to things. Maybe taking up and attaching. Yeah, once we crave, we want to ensure that our craving is met, our desires are met. How do we do that? By taking up certain ways of living our life. Yeah, so we decide to get a house for ourselves, we decide to get married, we decide to become a Buddhist. Yeah, why? Because Buddhism is good, it makes you happy, so you want to become a Buddhist. So, and all of these things, we take them up, they become part of our life. And then because they help us satisfy our cravings and our desires, we attach to stuff, we attach to things and people precisely because they are able to satisfy our craving in a certain way. Once we take up things, it means that our life tends to become fixed. Yeah, we take up work, you take up a family, you take up Buddhism. Well, that's it. Life is pretty much full already. And you've still got time for a little bit of sleep and a little bit of, you know, eating here and there. But that's about it. Life is full because your schedule is already packed. So your life then is formed by the things that we take up, the things we attach to, the thing we do in our life. And this is why it becomes existence, yeah? We exist in this way. From the taking up, we exist in a certain way. So this is your existence. How do you know what your existence is? To pin it down a little bit more precisely, one of the things that I suggest you do, look at the kind of things your mind thinks about in your meditation practice. If your mind is 100% peaceful, wonderful. If you think occasional thoughts, then watch those thoughts. If you think a lot of thoughts, watch those thoughts and see what the things that you think about. Those things that you think about, that is basically your existence. Those are the things that you are concerned about in life, yeah? That things that are important for you. Maybe things that about your family or your job or whatever, things you need to resolve. That is your existence. That is how you know what your bhava is. And you tend to rehash the same themes, yeah? We tend to think about the same thing again and again and again, ad nauseum. This is kind of the human mind. If you have a problem, you think about it again and again and again, and you can't find a solution. One day you stop thinking, bang, the solution comes to you. It's crazy, right? Why do we do this? Why do we keep thinking about it when the solution usually comes when we don't think about things? So notice that. It's kind of an insight. Okay, maybe I should stop thinking about it. Instead, just be quiet. It's a good way to learn how to have a quiet mind. So bhava, our existence. And then you know what your existence is. It's very similar to sankhara or activity at the beginning. That exists, and vijnana. That existence gives you a rough idea where your mind is at, your level of mind, yeah? And that will then affect your rebirth again. When the mind moves over, your birth on the other end will then be affected by that. And you will be reborn in a realm that corresponds to where your conscious, your existence before you got reborn. Once you are reborn in a particular realm, so you are stuck in that realm. Yeah, now you are stuck as a human being. Can't do much about that. And then you have to you have to experience the things that human beings experience. Yeah, whatever that is. You know, life, family life, and in the end you have to experience old age and death. Yeah, it's part of human life. Can't really escape death. So you have to experience old and death and all the other sufferings that come with human existence. If you get reborn somewhere else, you experience old age and death in those other realms and have the suffering that those other realms bring to you. This is how birth, obviously, must lead to old age and death and suffering. So we have been reborn, suffering must happen as a consequence. That is how dependent origination works. And that gives you, I think, a fairly good idea of what this is all about. So hopefully that will decipher all of those things quite a bit, and I will go through this in even more detail later on, try to unpack it even more, so hopefully we can get to understand this in even greater detail here. But before we do anything more, I think it's time to have a break here. I'm going to have some coffee, and please also have a drink or whatever you like, and we'll see you back again 3:15 here.